Well, good afternoon and welcome to Free to Be Faithful. I'm moderator Kip Allen. Free to Be Faithful is a religious liberty education awareness program created by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in response to increasing governmental incursions into religious life. People of faith and our institutions have come under increasing attack in recent years from secular sources. Abortion is one of the most controversial issues facing the country today. Since Roe v. Wade legalized elective abortion in 1973, nearly 60 million babies have been killed in the womb. But the battle still rages in state legislatures and courts across the land. One battle now in progress involves the state of Texas. That state passed a law mandating that abortion clinics must adhere to the same medical standards as outpatient ambulatory surgical clinics and have admitting privileges at local hospitals should a medical emergency arise during an abortion procedure. Now, opponents claim that the law would force most abortion clinics in the state to close, placing what they call an undue burden on women seeking elective abortions. That law was challenged and is now before the U.S. Supreme Court, which is expected to rule later this month in the case of Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt. Alliance Defending Freedom is a network of attorneys dedicated to religious freedom, and they're involved in the case. ADF attorney Steve Aden is our guest today, and we'll discuss ramifications of the case. Free to Be Faithful encourages our listening audience to ask questions on our telephone lines in the greater St. Louis area at area code 314-821-0850. Outside the St. Louis area in North America, the toll-free number is 1-800-730-2727. And the program may also be contacted by email at publicsquare@kfuo.org. Steve Aden is our guest today. I have him on the phone. Mr. Aden, could we start off by explaining a little bit about who you are and the organization you represent?
Sure, Kip. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm a senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom in the Washington, D.C. office, right here off Capitol Hill within actual sight of the Supreme Court. I was the principal attorney assisting a number of friends of the court, so-called amici. We filed our brief in the case, the abortion case you're referring to, Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, on behalf of the members of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American College of Pediatricians, Christian Medical and Dental Association, Catholic Medical Association, and Physicians for Life. And basically what our thousands of members told the court was that Texas had it exactly right. All they did was require abortionists to meet the same basic health and safety standards as other outpatient surgical providers follow. As it turns out, when you do that, when you require abortion providers to adhere to the same health and safety standards as other similar surgical providers, well, they can't do it. And a lot of them had to shut their doors. That's what this case is about, and we're privileged to be involved in it.
Now, this arose actually over what is called HB2, which was the law that was passed in the state of Texas, and I believe it was 2013. What is it that the bill actually does and mandates? I understand that you mentioned about the same standards with ambulatory patients, ambulatory surgical clinics, but I look at, for example, the case of the abortion doctor in Philadelphia who had that horror story where he had no standards imposed on him. And essentially, until this law was passed in Texas, Texas abortion clinics also had no standards. Is that correct?
Right. The outpatient practice of abortion was not regulated the way that other outpatient surgical practices are. So if you or I go in for something like a colonoscopy or LASIK, chances are very good, for example, that our provider, a doctor, will have admitting privileges, and the chance that something would go wrong, they would be able to admit us to a local hospital and follow up, take care of us there. That's never been the way that outpatient abortion providers have practiced, but now Texas is requiring them to do that. And so what this bill does, House Bill 2, is several things. But the salient points in the Supreme Court were the ambulatory surgical center requirements, meaning that they had to have each facility had to have hallways that were a certain width to get a gurney through if the EMTs need to respond there, certain antiseptic requirements, basic patient follow-up requirements, staffing requirements, fire and safety mandates, things like this, all the things that you would expect to see in a medical facility when you go there. And then second, House Bill 2 required the doctors providing abortion, as I said, in the event that there is a problem, such as excess bleeding or reaction to a medication or an inability to complete the abortion, the physician can put the woman in the ambulance, send her to the local hospital, and follow up with her there, because the hospital would know this provider, would know his or her credentials, and would know that it's safe for them to use the hospital. And that's, again, standard procedure for outpatient surgical practice, but not for ordinarily abortion providers.
Well, that's interesting that we discuss this, because I know that a lot of the opponents of this bill are saying that, well, abortions really are no more dangerous than a colonoscopy. Well, it just so happens my wife is a nurse at a colonoscopy center. And they actually do have emergencies arise every so often. Anytime there's a surgical procedure, you are running a risk, anything from reaction to the anesthesia to a perforation. And the same is true of the abortion clinics. They can deny it all they want, but the statistics just are not there. There is a medical, physical danger to an abortion procedure.
Absolutely. And when you track the incidents at abortion facilities, what you'll find is that a lot of these go under the radar. They're not known, they're not disclosed, because the abortion doctor doesn't have the ability to follow up. All they do is tell the poor woman to call the ER when something goes wrong. That's not the standard practice. What if you had a colonoscopy provider or LASIK provider that said, well, you know, if something goes wrong, just call the ER. You'll be fine there. That would not be accepted. That's not standard medical practice. And yet, with abortion providers, that's what they do. And so a lot of these incidents fall below the radar. They're underreported. But when you actually track at specific clinics using responses to 911 reports, like Operation Rescue, our friends there do, what you find is that there really is a high incident. One clinic in Maryland, I think it was, had several transports to the hospital in a particular year. These are women seriously injured enough to be put into a hospital and sent, put into an ambulance, sent to the hospital over a given year. And women have even died at abortion facilities or as a result of what goes on in abortion facilities. So you're right. There is no guarantee. There are risks. The risks are serious enough to warrant what the state of Texas did with House Bill 2, and we hope that the Supreme Court recognizes that and will uphold these common sense health and safety standards.
Now, this case involves an organization called Whole Woman's Health. What about them? Who are they, and why are they involved in this?
Whole Woman's Health is a string of abortion facilities run by a lady named Amy Hagstrom Miller, and they provide outpatient abortion services. When she complains that she will have to close many, if not most, of her facilities if the requirements are upheld, because she just financially won't be able to afford to comply, and her doctors won't be able to get admitting privileges. But again, we say that is an example of facilities that are substandard, that can't comply to basic health and safety requirements. And elsewhere in the media, she's also frequently seen complaining about Planned Parenthood, to be specific, that Planned Parenthood has such a hegemony in the field of abortion providers that they can't compete with them, and that economically they're being driven out. So I would take what she says with a grain of salt, because on one hand, she's complaining that the money side, the business side, isn't tenable because of what Planned Parenthood is doing in the operation of abortion. And on the other side, they're complaining about the health and safety standards. So they're a little bit dubious in my view.
Yeah, in fact, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal that appeared in March of this year that speculated on the case and even mentioned what you said about her complaining about Planned Parenthood, and the idea being that the entire demand for abortion, if you will, is declining, not just in the red states, but in blue states as well. Women simply are not having abortions at the rates that they once did. Good news for the pro-life side.
Yeah, and that's the good news, Kip. In fact, today in 2016, the abortion rate is no higher than it was back in 1973, and that's something we can praise God for. The demand for abortion spiked and went up to, it was at its highest point around 1990, 1992, and then dropped precipitously and has been dropping ever since. In fact, in the 7 years of the Obama administration, the most pro-abortion president we've ever had, abortion has dropped like a rock. All the money they poured into it, all the support for Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers has done no good. People just are turning away from the practice of abortion because I think they recognize it for what it is. It's the destruction of an innocent human life.
Now, some of the proponents of the pro-abortion side are saying, are referring back to a case called Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and that was the one that established the undue burden clause, I believe. How does that work?
Well, the undue burden standard of Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and probably not ironic, and probably not coincidentally, that case came out in 1992, the year that the abortion rate began to drop precipitously, has been applied to allow states to regulate abortion the way they do other similar outpatient providers. So this is the standard in this area of the law. And what it says is that the states can regulate abortion like any other medical practice, except when that regulation presents an undue burden on access to abortion. And what the Supreme Court said in Casey and a couple of other cases since then is that a measure that makes it more expensive for abortion providers to operate or more difficult for them to operate is not an undue burden. So a reasonable health and safety measure that simply reflects the standard of medical practice for outpatient surgeons like these do should not present a constitutional problem to the Supreme Court.
But we do have the case now before the Supreme Court, and since the death of Antonin Scalia, we've now seen a split court, 4 generally conservative to 4 generally liberal. The oral arguments were heard before this case, and we're expecting a ruling later this month. How did the oral arguments go, and what's going to happen? Regardless of the judgment, let's say if they can affirm it, they can reject it, or they can send it back to the lower case in the lower court. I think 5th court in this case, 5th court of appeal in the case of a tie. So what's going to happen now?
Well, nobody would prognosticate what will happen. The arguments, and I gave up to that a long time ago, but the arguments that took place on March 2nd of this year in the Supreme Court, I think went well. We mourn the loss, of course, of Justice Scalia, a great jurist, a great man, a great lover of Christ. But if the outcome depends on Justice Kennedy's vote, as it probably does, then the loss of Justice Scalia will not change the result because, at worst, you would get a 4-4 split, which would uphold the Fifth Circuit victory affirming the constitutionality of House Bill 2. Alternatively, you could get a decision where Justice Kennedy tracks back, so to speak, and takes back a lot of the things that he's said about abortion. He's in the past made it clear that he's no friend of the practice, but he could track back. He's evolving. I hope not on this issue. But if he does, he could find that the Texas House Bill 2 was unconstitutional in one or more respects because it simply denied too much access to abortion. There could be a split decision, and the court could come down in different ways between the surgical center regulations and the admitted privilege regulations and say one is constitutional and one is not. So there are a number of different scenarios. There's even discussion of one where they send it back down to the lower court for further fact-finding. I personally don't think that's very likely. But I am hopeful for a victory, for a decision that upholds or mostly upholds the good work that House Bill 2 has done and that allows the state to regulate abortion as the outpatient medical procedure that it is.
Well, a couple of things happened that give me some cause for hope, and you've pointed out the Fifth Court of Appeals did indeed uphold the law, so it's being challenged now not by our side, but by the other side. And this is, I think, a significant benefit, the fact that we're, the other side is on the defensive in this particular case. Now, if this law passes muster through the Supreme Court, or even if it doesn't, and the court says you've got to fix X, Y, and Z, it seems to me that this is creating a template law for all 50 states. Whatever the outcome of this is, states that are eyeing restrictions on abortion can look to this law and say, okay, here's what we need to do, here's what we don't need to do. Is that an accurate view?
I think it is. If you look at this, the history of state regulation of abortion since the Supreme Court more completely approved of that practice in 1992 with Planned Parenthood versus Casey, you see that the abortion rate, the popularity of abortion, is going down progressively as the states are regulating abortion more and more. So during the most of the 70s and the 80s, there was kind of this regime of hands-off. We don't want to touch abortion because it's a constitutionally protected practice. And that was the outlook of the Pennsylvania Department of Health. That's why they didn't inspect the Gosnell Clinic, and that's why all those horrific things happened over that course of 15 years. They didn't want to limit access, as the grand jury report said, because of their inspections of the abortion facilities. But now that we know, thanks to the Supreme Court, that states not only have the right but the duty to treat abortion the same as any other outpatient procedure, we would expect that the Supreme Court would hold to that and would say that House Bill 2's basic health and safety provisions would be upheld. We hope and expect that they will be.
Ironically, I think the pro-life side can take an argument that the pro-abort side has been using and say that this is a woman's health issue.
Well, it is. It is. As I mentioned, this is not a safe practice. There are risks. We think that the risks are underplayed by the other side and that there is not enough evidence because of the fly-by-night, under-the-radar nature of many abortion providers. And so what House Bill 2 does is bring them out into the open and force them to operate the same way as other similar outpatient medical providers. So when and if, by God's grace, House Bill 2 is upheld as constitutional by the Supreme Court, I think you're right. You'll see states across the country that haven't passed ambulatory surgical center protections like Texas's, and there are a couple of dozens that haven't, and admitting privileges provisions, there are a few more, probably three dozen there that have not passed those. I think you'll start to see those passed. I think you'll start to see abortion more and more regulated as any other medical procedure. And then when it's regulated as any other medical procedure is, maybe people will start to ask the question, why do we need to treat this as a constitutional right when it's regulated like any other medical procedure? A mother has to give her consent to have her 14-year-old daughter tattooed, for example, or to have her ears pierced. Why should the rule for abortion be any different? Hopefully and prayerfully, we'll see that. And people will begin to think, why is this a constitutionally protected practice when it need not be?
Hopefully it'll move it out of the legal and ideological scenario back into medical, where it really belongs. And you pointed out, I mean, there are regulations on hairdressers, for example, being licensed to shampoo, or people who do nails, pedicures, and manicures. Those have to be regulated by the state. Why not abortion?
That's right.
What other cases are we looking at now that are coming up before the Supreme Court that you're aware of? This issue is not going to go away, obviously. Both sides are entrenched, and this is one of those issues that there simply can be no compromise. There's no middle ground between the two sides. One way or the other, it's going to have to be resolved. It's almost like slavery, as Lincoln said, we can't exist half free and half slave. I think the same situation applies here to abortion. What's on the horizon for us?
I see three waves of cases, Kip. The first wave is similar cases that have to do with admitting privileges and surgical center requirements. And a number of these are parked just outside the Supreme Court and will go the way that the Hellerstedt case out of Texas decrees that they go. Those include cases from Louisiana, Wisconsin, Alabama, elsewhere. The second wave is a number of cases that are currently either in courts of appeal or very close to that, where states have just decided that Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers shouldn't receive a dime of public funding, that the taxpayers should demand accountability, should know where their money goes. And when you're talking about an operation that essentially subsidizes the ungodly practice of abortion, that's something the taxpayers just should not do. So a number of states have stripped abortion providers from Medicaid, for example. They've provided in other ways that public funds should not go to elective abortion providers. And I think you'll see those cases work their way up to the Supreme Court as well. And the third wave is the so-called new wave of laws that go a little bit beyond what you see in the Hellerstedt case, cases that point out the humanity of the child in the womb. For example, dismemberment abortion provisions, such as Kansas has passed and about 12 or 13 other states have passed, making it illegal for anyone for any reason to tear a baby limb from limb in the womb, a horrific practice that should be unspeakable in any civilized society. Just like the partial birth abortion debate wound up at the Supreme Court in the last major abortion decision in 2007, resulting in the Supreme Court's affirmation that this truly is horrific and barbaric, and Congress had a right to ban it. Hopefully, this third wave of cases that point up the humanity of the baby will get more and more people thinking about what abortion really is and does. So there's a lot to be hopeful about, whichever way the Supreme Court rules, and there's a lot to be prayerful about.
I think a lot of it, a lot of the sentiment that's changing over to our side on this actually comes largely from the Center for Medical Progress. Those videos that they released were appalling, absolutely appalling. Now, there has recently been an independent examination of the videos, and it came out that flat out the editing did not vary the content. It was solely for time. They did not change the meaning of the film. And, of course, the raw films themselves are available for anyone to look at online. And this does indeed show a horrific process of abortion. It is appalling. And I think that this has changed a lot of minds. People who were pro-choice, who have seen these films, have changed their minds.
Yes, and I think they've changed their minds because they've recognized that abortion providers, A, really do understand the humanity of the baby in the womb, and B, don't care. And so they are calloused. They talk, they act, they eat salad, they drink wine. As they discuss prices for baby parts, that's just like the discussion of how to collapse a baby's skull and suck the baby's brains out in partial birth abortion. So what these videos have done is a tremendous, tremendous public service. And I would note, by the way, in case your viewers have not heard, that the grand jury in Texas has dropped the charge against David DeLayden and the Center for Medical Progress that they had engaged in unlawful desire to purchase baby parts. So one of those two bogus charges has now been dropped, and we're hopeful that the second one will be dropped soon. But that's a partial vindication, but a big one for Center for Medical Progress's work, and we expect to see more.
Yeah, as the saying goes, truth will out, and it seems to be working in this case. We're certainly seeing, I think, a shift in the overall view of the public. I'm thinking specifically of the marches that we've seen in Washington in terms of the pro-life march. That happens every January in D.C. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is involved in that. One thing that has struck me in viewing this most recent one and the past ones is the change in the age of the average people who are out there now protesting against abortion. It used to be, especially after Roe v. Wade, it was generally some older folks. Now it's young people. A lot lot of them are getting involved and saying, this is wrong. I'm very encouraged by that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, waves and waves, hundreds of thousands of young people. In fact, the director for NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Activation League, got off the metro several years ago and looked around her during the March for Life and said, there are so many of them. They're so young, and there's so many of them. And she quit. we pray that many more pro-abortion leaders will quit when they see the waves of young people on the National Mall. And like you, I've been to march over the last number of years, and I've seen it grow. It's just amazing to me how big it is now. And I hope and pray that the powers that be in the Supreme Court and the Congress are paying attention, that they're not covering their eyes and ears when they see Constitution Avenue covered by marchers from the Supreme Court all the way down to the National Mall. It's an amazing, amazing sight.
Yeah, I think there were 600,000 at the largest demonstration a couple of years ago. It's very inspiring.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see.
One thing I've been looking at, I don't know if anything is going to happen with this, but you talked earlier a bit about public funding with groups, for example, like Planned Parenthood. What bothers me over and above the idea of taxpayer supporting of this thing is that this organization then turns around and donates the same money to politicians who give them money.
Well, they do, and they have promised to spend millions in this election this fall to affect the outcome and to impose their pro-abortion agenda. That's why I think it behooves God's people to be involved in the political process, to give of their time and their treasure to affect that outcome as well. Because the folks that are in office at whatever level, from national down to local offices, really affect the course of the life issue. And, you know, that's one very important way to do it.
Absolutely.
Because the other side certainly knows that it is.
Well, the LCMS is very adamant about the two kingdoms concept, that God works in both heaven and on earth, and that we as Christians have an obligation to interact with our government. And we are looking at this upcoming election with very, very closely. And the concept that we are saying more and more, and we are hearing more and more, is vote your values. So know who's saying what, know who your representatives are, know how they stand on this and other issues as well. These are trying times for Christians and people of faith. Jews, Muslims, everyone. These are trying times. And the secular side is fighting very hard. But I think we're starting to see a little bit of a turnaround, God willing.
Amen.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Aden. It is a privilege having you on this program. And the work that ADF has been doing is just awesome. I have followed your organization for a long time, and they are doing some wonderful work. And people can see what you're doing. I think your website is adflegal.org. Is that correct?
That is. Thank you.
And everything from who's involved, cases that are followed, specific issues, there are position papers. It's a wonderful website, and a lot of things are going on. And there's a lot of things that the ADF is doing, a lot of things that we really need to follow and to follow along. You've been listening to Free to Be Faithful, which is a presentation of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod as a religious liberty, education, and awareness program. Free to Be Faithful airs the third Wednesday of every month at 2:30 p.m. and is rebroadcast the following Saturday at 9:30 a.m. Central Time. It's also available for download on our website at kfuo.org. Our today's guest was Mr. Steve Aden of the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm your host, Kip Allen, wishing you a very God-blessed day.